Philip Shaw joins us now, senior advisor and CFP at Goldstone Financial Group. GoldstoneFinancialGroup.com is the website. Philip, the markets are, well, let's talk about inflation first. For the, what was it now, 12th straight month, it went down again, right?
Yeah, we started seeing some really nice inflation numbers coming through. Just from June, the year-over-year inflation was down to 3% compared to the prior June, which is, it's nice to see that finally coming back in line with where we want it.
I wonder what the most important set of numbers is for us. Is it where the indexes are? Is it inflation? Is it interest rates? What's the number that I should maybe most pin my hopes on?
Well, I guess it depends on what we're talking about. You know, inflation is the biggest one for the Federal Reserve and what they're planning on doing. You know, obviously they've had a pretty serious series of increases in the last year and a half here with interest rates. And inflation is going to be the question of, are they going to raise rates again, you know, next time? And if they do, how is that going to impact the markets, and how's that going to impact your portfolio?
Yeah. Well, they are going to raise it next time. I mean, that's pretty well, that's a pretty safe bet, isn't it? Up a quarter point?
Yeah. You know, I think we're back in line with where the Fed wants inflation. So the goal is 2% long-term inflation, but that's also an average. You know, we spent a lot of the last decade near to 0%. We've been higher than that recently. We're back down to 3. As long as we're in that range, I think they're going to call that good enough. But I agree with you. After seeing what we went through in the 1970s, I think the Federal Reserve really wants to nail this one in, and we're going to get another, we will see another quarter point increase here coming.
Do you think that'll impact the markets then?
You know, I think the markets largely priced that in. A lot of what we'll see, you know, from a downside of the market, if the Fed comes in and says, we're raising a quarter point, and by the way, expect another one, that might have a bigger impact on the market. But I think this next quarter point's been built in.
Bigger impact on the market in what way? What would happen then?
You know, there's a lot of concern about companies being able to continue financing at cheap rates. And if the Federal Reserve keeps raising rates and cooling the economy, we might see, you know, worse earnings coming out of some of the companies. And I'm not saying a crash, but we might see another downturn in the market from that.
Boy, that'd be a shame, because we've had a nice little run here lately. What's that all about? What's fueling the last few weeks here?
So a lot of this is, you know, what from my perspective is, you know, that soft landing scenario that they've been talking about, basically being able to cool the economy down without pushing us into a serious recession, without pushing us into a crash of any sort. And considering how well everybody's held up through the last year and a half of this, a lot of people are starting to look optimistic towards the future. I will say the other thing in there is there's been a lot of optimism about AI and a lot of the releases we've seen from that in the last year with ChatGPT and all the potential around that is definitely driving some higher valuations of companies.
Yeah, I'd like to see a broader based index, but it just seems to me, and I wonder if a lot of people feel this way. You can do comment, but inflation is the cost of eggs today and tomorrow, but how these markets perform overall, our investment portfolios, our mutual funds, our retirement, our pensions, all of that is how we're going to live not tomorrow, but for the next 35 years. So I would hope that the Fed would realize that inflation is largely being tamed, and let's not do anything to mess with the long-term growth of our retirement funds.
To be honest, that's my exact hope is, you know, we've really gotten back in line with where we want the economy and with where we've wanted inflation, and it's time to stop the process they're going through. But, you know, they're the expert in the field, so they say. My opinion is we are where we wanted to be, and they can stop raising rates, but I'd expect at least one more, you know, quarter point here.
That's Philip Shaw, senior advisor at Goldstone Financial Group, goldstonefinancialgroup.com. Philip, always interesting. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Bree, let's just start with real quick here, because I think we can do it quickly. How well Netflix is doing. Can you talk about their earnings report?
Sure. They had a pretty good second quarter, mainly because they announced that they added millions of subscribers in the last quarter, and the revenue went up. You know, losing subscribers had been something that the company had been worried about for a while, people sharing passwords, things like that. It's cracked down on that, and it's seeing subscriber growth now.
Are you surprised?
I mean, not really. This is something that, you know, that they've been trying to do for a while. They've also added an ad-based tier where people can pay less and deal with ads. And, yeah, I think that appeals to a lot of consumers these days.
I thought they didn't report their viewership numbers and earnings. What am I missing here?
I mean, Netflix is publicly traded, so they do the quarterly earnings just like everybody else. Their profit was pretty flat compared to a year ago, but the fact that, you know, they're bringing in more money and more subscribers, and more importantly, not losing subscribers, is very key for them.
I'm just reading from what you all said that its global subscriber total is now 238 million. The company said there had been scant resistance to its password sharing crackdown. And while the new advertising tier that they introduced in November is a small component, they think that's going to grow. I guess, we all ranted and raved about this crackdown on password sharing, but if you want Netflix, you got to play by their rules, and evidently the product is good enough that people are willing to pay for it, right?
Right. I mean, there's just a lot of content out there. I think with the actors and the writer strikes now, too, people are going to be looking to kind of maybe dive into that Netflix content a bit more. And, you know, those British detective shows and things like that are just going to be a lot more appealing than they used to be.
I guess so. And is the crackdown, such as it is, complete? Because I haven't seen my Netflix interface change, and I'm not sure if I'm paying for it. Do you know where they are in that rollout?
You know, it's really unclear. I mean, I'm sure it's one of those things that the guys behind the scenes are constantly tweaking. You don't want to cause problems for people that are legitimately paying for your service.
Yeah.
People hate friction. They hate dealing with, you know, annoying things that may stop them from logging in fast enough, stuff like that. And the thing is, there are a lot of other streaming services out there now that people could switch to.
Yeah, do you have an opinion, a preference about which is the easiest to navigate? Because I sometimes find myself clicking on platforms just wanting to watch something. And it's sort of like when you used to just channel surf. Now I platform surf, but some are easier to do that than others. Is there a personal preference for you?
You know, I have an Apple TV that kind of just funnels everything in that I watch, which is kind of nice. My biggest problem are my kids use it too, and they're too lazy to log into their own accounts, so they'll be adding their shows to mine, and it really messes with whatever algorithm is suggesting content because, you know, my 9-year-old son's tastes are a little different than mine.
No kidding. Well, I've noticed that too with our shared accounts. It'll say, because you were watching, and I thought, I'm not watching this stuff. Who's watching this stuff? I don't want to watch anything like that either. But maybe I need my own account. Talk to me about what's the deal with Call of Duty and all of these games that Activision Blizzard has. Is that merger with Microsoft happening?
Well, this is kind of the unending soap opera of the merger and acquisitions world right now. It's been going on forever. They've just delayed and given themselves more time, setting a new deadline for October. This was supposed to wrap up this month. But the companies are dealing with antitrust issues in the U.S. and, more importantly, in Great Britain. The EU has already signed off on the deal, but British regulators are still looking at it. And, you know, the fact that they've set a new deadline kind of shows that, you know, they have some confidence that this will close eventually. But there still are a lot of things that need to be hammered out.
The United Nations had a session on AI. That's interesting. What do they have to say about the trend?
Well, I mean, just like any other governmental or, you know, non-governmental organization, they're worried about, you know, the path that we might be headed down globally. You know, every country kind of has a different attitude and a regulatory policy towards AI. And this is just kind of, you know, they were talking about things and just, you know, warning that there might be a path for criminals and terrorists and other people, you know, intent on causing, quote, death and destruction, widespread trauma, psychological damage on an unimaginable scale, unquote. You know, there's a lot of, you know, uncertainty out there about AI, and the UN is just the latest body to kind of get in there and, you know, start looking at things.
Yeah, no kidding. And I guess it's easy to sound alarmist about this, but it really is a new thing, isn't it? This is different than any other kind of software that we've dealt with before, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly been out there for a while. I think people just are kind of finding out about it on a, you know, a human consumer level because of the advent of things like ChatGPT that anyone can play with and do things with. You know, industries, businesses, they've been using AI or, you know, more accurately, machine learning to do things for years. But we're definitely seeing a big tide of change coming. It's just a question of where that leads us. You know, yeah. AI can be used to do a lot of great things, you know, when it comes to, you know, heavy mass computations, things like that, scientific research. But, you know, there are worries about jobs and about, you know, this being used to spread disinformation. I mean, it's Pandora's box is open. It's just, you know, how we're going to deal with it.
Yeah, I'm worried about democracy if I think about it, but maybe it doesn't mean that we can't have our cake and eat it. I wonder if we are going to hold the developers of AI accountable the way we try and hold platform developers accountable. That is, if you're Facebook and there's crap on your site, should we ask Facebook to be a monitor of that? I don't know how we're going to get our head around that with artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that honestly a lot of other countries are further ahead on than the U.S. The EU is already has a framework that they're trying to get passed through their governmental bodies. Congress really hasn't done much. They've supposedly had some classified briefings, but, you know, we haven't really seen any policy or proposed policy out there yet.
Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET. Let's talk next week, Bree. Thank you for your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next on the Wintrust Business Lunch, Larry Nissenson, Chief Growth Officer at Assured Allies. That's their website, assuredallies.com. And Larry, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. How are you?
I am doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your organization. What do you all do?
We're just trying to tackle this small problem of helping the 65-plus million folks over the age of 65 make successful aging part of their life. We're trying to help them live the best version of their life possible. Just a small task.
How are you like or not like AARP?
We're like AARP in the sense that we're highly concentrated on the same demographics. The difference for us is that we're bringing products and services to the market to help people proactively do it through a coaching model, and we're actually working one-on-one with aging seniors and aging adults to help them make small incremental changes in their lives that will benefit them later and down the road.
Products and services, but also coaching people. First, talk about the products and services. What are those?
So they're predominantly centered around the long-term insurance, the long-term care insurance business. So we work with insurance companies to build them products where people can protect their aging environment. And then we put personalized coaching in to not only give them the insurance protection, but more importantly, to help them create the roadmap by working with a health coach to map out what their custom journey looks like. What are the areas of wellness that the individual policyholder would benefit from? And then how do we help them achieve those?
You said an insurance product for things that are important to them. What are you talking about there? Give me a little more specifics.
Sure. We're our first partner that we're actually in market with, which is a Chicago-based company, is Equitrust Life Insurance Company. With them, we built a fixed annuity product so people can save, actively save, and prepare for their retirement through an annuity. And as part of that annuity, they get a long-term care insurance product as well as our wellness program that helps them save for retirement and then prepare and take themselves into potential long-term care needs and use those dollars to help solve how they're going to pay for their long-term care needs when they need them.
Long-term care insurance, is that what we're talking about? Because I know that's...
That is exactly what we're talking about.
And then how expensive is that? When should people start to purchase that?
The expense question is a great question, and the when is also a really good question. We know, you know, the average long-term care cost is going to be somewhere just over $200,000. That's the average long-term care cost that's going to be attributed to somebody. And about 70% of those over the age of 65 are going to have a long-term care event during their lifetime. So when we think about what is it that they're trying to protect and cover, that's really the number of what they should aim for. In terms of the cost, the cost isn't as expensive as they say. It's hard to really talk through because there's health-related questions. But what we tell people is there is always a policy for most people, even if they can't afford or don't have the discretionary income to buy a policy to cover all of it. Anything they do to help out, John, is certainly to their benefit. And from an aging standpoint, traditionally those in their early to mid-50s are when we see people starting to look at long-term care insurance policies, and we see people purchasing them up through the age of 75.
I wonder if it's, though, like any insurance product, if you start to buy it that late in the game, then the premiums are so high because it's almost certain that you're going to need it before you've paid a lot into the company. So talk about that.
Yeah, that is exactly true. We see the sweet spot as generally being late 50s, early 60s is when it becomes sort of the more affordable annual premium, and it allows them to sort of predict. We know that the average person, when they need this, it's usually in their late 70s is when they start to collect on the benefits. And so it's easier to do sort of a cost-benefit analysis, right? I'm going to pay premiums for roughly 15 or 20 years, and I think this is the expected cost. And to really leverage that, by the way, there's some amazing sites that people can go to predict what the cost of care will be depending on where they live throughout the country and when they think they'll need that care.
I wonder what the duration is of long-term care insurance payouts. How long will I need it?
Well, so the average claim is for a little bit less than 3 years. But we've seen examples, by the way, of those who suffer from some of the longest and most serious dementia-related cases, et cetera, you know, having claims for 5, 6, 8, 10 years at times. Most people are trying to cover about 3 years of cost is what they aim for, though.
I wonder if there's a disagreement about the application of those funds. That is, you may say, hey, I need that now, and the insurance company says, actually, you don't fall into the category of criteria that we feel is necessary to actually pay out. Who makes the determination on that?
That's a great question. And for sure, some of the older long-term care insurance products did work that way. I will tell you that the product that I mentioned earlier by Equitrust called the Bridge product, that in order to access that, you just need a doctor who says you can't satisfy two of the six activities of daily living. Those include things like dressing and getting out of bed and showering and being able to change your clothes and toilet, et cetera. And once you've satisfied that through your own doctor or an independent doctor, you actually don't even need to submit receipts. Once you're on claim, you can access your money, and it's a much more liberal version of what used to be part of what Assured Allies is doing. Is really helping to modernize the view of what long-term care insurance is. And the claims process that you described is one of those areas that we're seeing great modernization in.
We're talking to Larry Nissenson, who is the Chief Growth Officer at AssuredAllies.com is their website. Does that money, can it be used at home, or does it have to be used in some sort of senior care facility?
Yeah, actually, with the Equitrust product, they can use it for whatever they would like. In the old style policies, that question that you asked about, do I need to use it in a facility? Can I use it for home health care? was a germane question. Lots of carriers required you to use it in formal care.
Yeah.
The newer products really allow you to use that. Once you're qualified, you can use those dollars in for any way that you see fit, whether they're for your care or not.
One last question. If I had $10 million, I wouldn't probably need this. I would just, rather than pay the premium, continue to fund my assets and just pay from my store of money. I wonder what the cutoff line is on the top side, after which you don't need this sort of long-term care insurance.
You know, it's interesting because we hear a lot from people that same question, right? When can I self-insure? When is it unnecessary for me? And what we tell them is this: even if you had a $10 million estate, if you were worth $10 million, the question is around leverage, right? If I told you it was likely you were going to have to spend $300,000 for a long-term care event, would it be worth spending some portion of that to insure against it so that you could leave the bulk of your money to your loved ones or to your favorite charity or use it in the way that you deemed worthy of your cause? And for some people, the answer is no, I would rather just take it out of that. And it's hard to pinpoint what the exact estate size is. What we tell people is long-term care needs are going to affect a great number of people. Again, 70% of those over the age of 65. Yeah. And the cost of that insurance is relatively inexpensive to that $300,000 need. What we encourage people to do is to look at the cost of coverage, irrespective of the size of your estate, and then decide if it's something that you want to purchase, or if you want to do as you suggested and just self-insure for that coverage.
Larry Nissenson, Chief Growth Officer, AssuredAllies.com. Larry, very interesting, very germane. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks for having me, John. Have a great day.
More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Prices of Chicago area homes have hit a new record high. A new report from a statewide realtors group says the median price of homes in the nine-county metro area rose 2.9% in June to $349,940 compared to last year. That's the highest price from records that go back to 2008. The median home price in the city of Chicago fell 3.3% in June to $332,900. It's been down for 9 of the past 11 months. The Metro data covers Cook, DeKalb, DuPage, Grundy, Kane, Kendall, Lake, McHenry, and Will counties. Suburban Chicago-based Abbott Laboratories is putting the focus back on medical devices and nutritional products, its core business. The company's quarterly financial report out today shows sales fell more than 11% in the second quarter. Excluding COVID tests, the company saw domestic and international revenue growth of 11% to 12%. Abbott's medical device, pharmaceutical, and nutritional sectors all saw growth during the quarter. The company's CEO told investors it was a strong start to the first half of the year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Matt Schultz is the chief credit analyst at LendingTree.com. Welcome back, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Talk about grocery rewards cards with us today. I hear more chat about that. Is that a good thing for me to have in my wallet?
It certainly can be. Like any credit card, like almost any financial transaction, it kind of depends on what you're looking for and how much you spend as to which card is right for you. And we found in our latest report that with grocery rewards in particular, where you spend plays a really big role in what you can expect to earn too.
So we're talking like Walmart, Costco, Sam's Club, stuff like that?
Potentially, but what we found is that a lot of grocery rewards cards will explicitly separate those types of purchases from Walmart, Costco, Target, places like that, and say that you cannot earn grocery rewards from them. And that can be a really big surprise to people, but it can also be really frustrating, because it's not always 100% clear immediately when you get these cards that those exclusions are part of it.
I'm going to ask you which ones you like the best in a minute, but I want to make sure I understand what we're talking about. I thought like a Sam's Club card, a Sam's Club credit card would be used at Sam's Club and I would get points. Of course, Costco is not going to take that. Walmart's not going to take that. So what are we talking about?
Well, there are cards like, for example, the Blue Cash Preferred card from American Express and others give cash back or points for grocery spending at supermarkets and places like that, along with the other things that they give rewards for. So that's a separate spot from the grocery chain specific cards like Kroger and places like that.
Well, I tend to use my credit card for just about everything for the purposes of points. And granted, I like the idea of a debit card because then the money's out of my account and I know how much I have. But if I do my best to pay my credit card on time, then I'm using their money. So that's great. But do you have a recommendation for me on that? Should I just use a general bank card with the best terms at the grocery store, or should I use a grocery store card?
Well, it really depends on your specific spending habits. If you are somebody who does a lot of your grocery shopping at Walmart or Target or Costco or places like that, it may make sense for you to get that retailer's cards in the same way that if you fly American Airlines, it may make sense to get that card. But if you're somebody who shops just generally at a few different places, it may be worth looking into kind of a more general purpose grocery card that gives you those extra rewards in multiple supermarket places.
I got about a minute left. What cards do you like in that regard?
The one that gives the highest return that we found was that Blue Cash Preferred card from American Express. It's 6% cash back on up to $6,000 per year. And that can end up earning you $300 plus for the average household based on what they spend. So it can be a good card if it matches your spending habits.
6% back on the purchases you make, that does sound high to me. Am I hearing you correctly on that?
Yeah, no, 6% is what they're offering. There is a $95 annual fee, but it is waived for the first year. So at a minimum, in that first year, it's a pretty significant earnings potential.
There's an article titled, "The Right Card Can Earn You Hundreds in Grocery Rewards." And you'll find it at LendingTree.com. Matt Schultz, always interesting and helpful. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.